Hello everyone, I am Jessica Saxton, the Environmental Education and Outreach Leader through United Communities AmeriCorps and the host of Living Downstream. Umpqua Watersheds values both human and ecological diversity. We acknowledge that the land upon which Umpqua Watersheds is located was formerly occupied and tended by various indigenous groups, including Cow Creek Umpqua, Coquille, Mulala, and others. Their history is intertwined with this place, and we seek to continue to practice stewardship and reciprocity towards the natural environment which indigenous people did for thousands of years prior to European settlement. We celebrate the strengths and perspectives that different people have to offer, and believe that organizations, communities, and ecosystems are all more resilient when they embrace the unique gifts various individuals can contribute. Hello, everyone. I am Jessica Saxton, the Environmental Education Outreach Leader through United Communities AmeriCorps and one of the hosts of Living Downstream. Welcome. I have Stephen Rumrill, the Shellfish Program Leader for Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. Thank you for joining us as the guest speaker for this episode. Would you like to introduce yourself and explain a little bit about what you do?
Sure. Thank you, Jessica. So my name is Steve Rumrill, and I'm the leader for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife Shellfish Program. That's a big program that encompasses a wide diversity of tasks, including monitoring the commercial shellfish fisheries and the recreational shellfish fisheries on behalf of the state. So what are shellfish fisheries? So those are what we conventionally know as the crab and clams, mussels, shrimp, sea urchins, sea stars, scallops, abalone, that whole group of marine invertebrates, marine and estuarine invertebrates that have a shell and that are harvested typically for food. So I've got a great group of people, a staff of about 15 to 18 people, and we're scattered all over the coastline from Astoria down to Gold Beach and Brookings, and keeping an eye on the commercial take for money, for, you know, retail markets, and also the recreational take of shellfish. I also oversee the program for shellfish science and characterization. So I've got another dedicated team of people who work out in the field, call them the estuarine gypsies, but they're out characterizing using quantitative science methods to count and measure and estimate the biomass of shellfish, bay clams, and shrimp, et cetera, that are available for harvest. And then they also characterize the seagrass beds and tide flats in the intertidal zone, subtidal zone, to just keep a good gauge on the health of these communities. And then we also interact, of course, with students and faculty at the universities and with other agencies and with the tribal natural resource departments to conduct science investigations to better understand how these organisms fit into their environment, how the populations are doing, to understand any threats or challenges to them. So it's a great job. I'm very happy to be in this position on behalf of the state.
Thank you for the introduction. Our first question we're going to start off with is, what's the difference between starfish, sea stars, and asteroids?
Yes, that's a great question. So the sea stars, I'll call them sea stars, but sea stars, starfish, asteroids, they're all the same thing. So they're a class within the greater phylum of echinoderms. So that large group includes the sea urchins, the spiny sea urchins and sand dollars, and then the class asteroids, which includes the sea stars, starfish. And those are typically thought of as the five-armed sea stars, but they can have multiple rays. Some have six arms, some have 20 arms, but that's that class. And this phylum echinoderms also includes the brittle stars, the tiny little ones with really snaky arms, almost like snakes. The crinoids, which are those big, beautiful feather stars that you may see, especially emerging at night out on coral reefs in warm waters, and the sea cucumbers as well. So it's a broad phylum, and then the sea stars are a subgroup or the class within that phylum, kind of the model.
That makes sense. I always called them starfish.
It's a big dichotomy within this group here, and there's no real difference between them. But it's just some people raised up calling them starfish and others sea star.
Yeah.
They're not fish.
Okay.
They're closely related to the sea urchins and sand dollars and brittle stars and sea cucumbers.
Okay. So where can we find these on the Oregon coast?
Yeah, so sea stars occur in a variety of different habitats. They're primarily marine, meaning that they're mostly out in the full-strength ocean waters, but they can also occur in the mouths of the bays and estuaries, so they can tolerate a little bit of dilution by fresh water. So they're out in the marine-dominated parts of the bays and estuaries, and primarily out in the full marine waters. It can occur in the rocky intertidal zones and tide pools, and that's typically where we see the most commonly observed ochre sea stars, which are purple and orange, and they're in the tide pools, side channels. They can withstand quite a bit of force from energy and waves. And then when you get down into the subtidal zone, the shallow subtidal zone, by scuba diving or snorkel diving, that's where they really come out, and there's lots of species there. So they're typically in rocky habitats, but they can extend down into pretty deep water. Sometimes you find them in eelgrass beds or attached to the pilings, the wooden pilings supporting docks and piers out in the bays and estuaries. They can occur in unvegetated mud and sand flats down in the mouths of the bays or out in deeper water. And in some cases, stars like the sunflower sea star or other deep water stars can extend way out in mud flats and deep water mud, way out into deep waters.
That's very interesting. Out of curiosity, is there any damage if people touch a sea star in the tide pools? Does it do any damage to them?
Well, they're pretty rugged, and thanks for asking about that. They're tough on the outside and soft on the inside, you know, those kind of critters. So you can damage them if you pull them off the rock, because they hang on with these really delicate and powerful tube feet, suction feet that are operated through their internal system. But they're hanging on tight, you know, they're trying to make a living out there and withstand being hit by waves and washed off. And then when the tide goes out, a human comes by and pulls them off. And that will typically cause them to rip their tube feet. And it'll take them some time away then from feeding to be able to heal those wounds. Other times you may find them disrupted or out on the beach. So they've let go and are being washed around. And in that case, I think it's a humanitarian thing to do to pick it up and throw it back out into the water so it doesn't dry out. You know, that kind of thing. So use your best judgment. They're pretty tough. They can withstand, you know, some agitation, but please don't rip them off if they're hanging on tight, especially if they're trying to pull apart a muscle and get their dinner. It'd be no fun to be ripped off your table right while you're in the middle of eating dinner.
Thank you. How did you become interested in the well-being of sea stars?
Well, so I'm trained as a marine biologist through all of my years, and my professional job here on behalf of the state is to look out for the well-being of shellfish, to encourage people to harvest them and, you know, make use of them for food, either the commercial or recreational side. But I also have public trust responsibilities to watch out for sea stars on their own behalf. And so I'm interested in all shellfish and all marine invertebrates, but I have a particular fondness for all of the echinoderms. And I've been just keeping an eye on them. My own research, personal research when I was a student, was focused on the echinoderms, brittle stars, and sea stars, sea urchins. And so I really do watch out for them. And then just keeping mental notes and observations on how the populations are doing. I've had the good fortune to work with echinoderms and sea stars in California and Oregon, Washington, British Columbia, and even along the coast of Florida and up in the coast of Massachusetts. So I've been fortunate to see them in a variety of different habitats, different species, and it's just a group that I really have a fondness. I've been interested in them for a long, long time. And it kind of breaks my heart to see the situation that we're in now with the decline of particular species, which we'll talk about a little bit later.
Yeah, that is terrible. Do you want to tell me about the sea star wasting disease? How did the mass mortality event impact sea stars along the West Coast?
Yes, so sea star wasting disease is really a terrible event, disease that has caused the mortality of a great number of species and literally billions of individuals. Starting back in about 2013, 2014, West Coast wide, we began to notice that sea stars in intertidal zone and shallow subtidal zone were literally melting, falling apart. They didn't look good, and very rapidly over a period of a few days, the individuals would come apart and decay and just disintegrate. And so there was a lot of concern about that, and this mortality event swept through the coastline, first noticed up in British Columbia, down in California, lagged a little bit here, but then followed very quickly in Oregon. And soon the whole West Coast was experiencing this massive die-off. It's estimated that billions of sea stars, multiple species, about 20 species or more, were impacted. And researchers who are investigating this event are now offering up their opinion that this could have been the largest marine disease event ever. And so a very wide, widespread, affected many species across the whole West Coast. We've had big disease events like that have affected sea stars and sea urchins in the past, but never on that scale, never that many species all at once. So it's something that really started here and was noticed about 10 years ago, a little over 10 years ago or so, and has continued on at a lower rate up through the present time. Some species like the orange and purple ochre stars that we see in the Rocky Intertidal Zone have shown good evidence of recovery. Their populations really declined quite a bit, and there was a lot of concern, but now we've seen good recovery in particular areas, and there were some hot spots where the populations were not. But other species have shown this massive decline and have not shown recovery. So those are the ones that we're really concerned about now.
And out of curiosity, do you guys know what's causing the sea star wasting disease?
Yes, that's an excellent question, and it's a very difficult question. Science academic investigators, particularly at Cornell University, have been doing some good pioneering work trying to figure out the causative agent of sea star wasting disease. And the initial research was pointing to a virus, a marine virus known as adenovirus, kind of like a parvovirus that can impact puppies and such. There's a lot of evidence that it was picked up from the water and could be passed from individual to individual, very similar to the viruses and flus that we're dealing with in the COVID pandemic. And so lots of thought about that and good investigative work there. Other investigators are now also looking at another causative agent that's linked more closely to changes in the local environment. Sea stars breathe through these little extensions of skin that extend up, soft tissues that extend up all over the surface, known as a dermal papillae. And when there's a disruption of the microbiotic bacteria community associated with the breathing apparatus, the sea stars then can, in essence, suffocate. The dissolved oxygen levels right at the skin-water interface will go down to the point where the sea stars can't breathe, and they begin to suffocate. And sea stars have this autoimmune response where they can cast off damaged or decayed infected parts of their body. So when that occurs throughout, they just turn on their autoimmune response and cast off an arm and open up this part of the body and cast off that part, and they just fall apart. So could be a combination of both virus and the disruption of the microbial communities. But in any case, it does appear to be related to warming ocean waters and perhaps to lower levels of dissolved oxygen and perhaps nutrient over enrichment at the area. It's hard for these animals to get all that stuff off of them. So if they end up with a disrupted microbial community just all over their skin, it's very difficult to cast that off.
Does the sea star wasting disease impact any other like mussels, or is it just
the asteroids?
Yes.
This event seems to be restricted only to the asteroids. So that's a great question. We were looking and did not see mass mortality of sea urchins or sand dollars or the sea cucumbers, other classes within the phylum Echinodermata. This one was only restricted to the sea stars.
Okay. So you mentioned the sunflower sea star. What is the sunflower sea star and how do they compare with other species?
Yeah, so the sunflower sea stars are really big, soft-bodied, massive, comparatively massive predators out in the subtidal zone. Sometimes you see them in the intertidal zone, but their realm is really out in the shallow subtidal zone, extending out to anywhere from the surface down to about 300 meters of depth. So they're creatures of the deep, and they're a particularly important and voracious big predator. By big, I mean they can get up to the size of a garbage can lid. So pretty good, fast. Their name, Pycnopodia, comes from, Pycno is Latin for dense. So dense, and then podia means foot. So dense feet, meaning they have lots and lots and lots of tube feet. And then Helianthoides is Latin referring to the sunflower. So it's a sunflower with dense tube feet. But what they do is they're generalist predators. They eat all kinds of other organisms, other sea stars, they're cannibalistic. They eat sea urchins and sea cucumbers. They'll trap down crab. They'll dig up clams that are buried down underneath the sand or mud. They can use those dense tube feet to move and excavate a hole. You can imagine a clam that doesn't have anywhere to go but down. And so when they extend their neck up above the surface, and if it's detected by a sea star, the sea star starts to dig on it. So it'll retract, the clam will retract down into the hole. And the Pycnopodia are relentless. It'll take a month to dig up a clam, just grain size by grain, digging down there and finally get it. And if they get a good clam that's got the same biomass, wow, what a meal for them. It's worth it for them. But anyways, they're big, iconic, known as the king of sea stars. And they may, by biomass, be the largest species of sea star in the world. There is a deep water animal that has longer rays, but they're very thin and slender. And by comparison, the sunflower stars are big, massive, soft-bodied sunflower stars, big predators in the subtidal zone.
So since they are soft-bodied, is that different than other sea stars that have a hard outer shell?
Yeah, that's a good question. So there's a lot of diversity in the sea stars. Some like the ochre stars that are adapted to living in the high-energy wave environment have a really tough, rugged, almost leather-like exterior. And then others that are more flexible and fast moving and living in less high energy environments typically have a softer body and are putting some more of their energy into the soft tissues rather than the need for those heavy protective calcium carbonate covers. Those calcium carbonate elements of their skeleton in sea stars are the same kind of material as in a sea urchin. In a sea urchin, they're all stuck together, cemented together into a hard ball. But in the sea stars, they've dissipated throughout the soft tissue and allow them to move and be more flexible.
That's very cool. I did not know that. I thought they were all hard-shelled and soft inside.
Yeah.
And we will be back with this episode of Living Downstream real soon.
Roseburg's Independent Radio 99.7 KQUA.
And we are back. So how does the sea star wasting disease impact the sunflower sea star?
Yeah, so we're estimating that anywhere from 5 to 6 billion individuals of the sunflower sea star have died and disappeared in response to this mass mortality event. That's a huge number. And so it's impacted their populations throughout their biogeographic range. The sunflower sea star's biogeographic range extends from the Aleutian Islands all throughout the Southeast Alaska coast and the convoluted coast of British Columbia, throughout Washington, the Salish Sea and Puget Sound, down along the outer coast of Washington and Oregon, California, and extending through Southern California all the way down into Baja, Mexico. Their populations or individuals have been impacted throughout that range. And our best guess is about 5.7 billion individuals lost. Overall, that represents about 95% of the population has disappeared recently. And the extent of loss has been greater down in the southern part of the range. California and Baja, Mexico have felt the greatest loss. And there are still some holdouts in populations up in Alaska and British Columbia. But overall, about 95% loss. Here in Oregon, we estimate about 99% loss from our observations here. So it's really impacted their numbers in a great way. Now, one of the concerns is we're hoping that the populations that still exist up in the north, in Washington, British Columbia, Alaska, should be able to produce enough reproductive output to be able to keep the population alive there. And we do have scattered observations here in Oregon and California. So we're hoping that observations in areas that aren't really observed very much may be able to, you know, help the population from going extinct.
Thank you. How will the loss of these large predators impact food webs in the marine environment?
Yeah, I mentioned earlier that sunflower sea stars are generalist predators that feed upon a large variety and diversity of other marine invertebrates. So you can imagine when the top dog, you know, the top wolf keystone predator in the system disappears with the loss of the sunflower sea stars, that will allow the other organisms that were normally preyed upon by them to flourish. And we believe that is what's occurring, in particular with very large numbers now of sea urchins. Sea urchins are grazers, other echinoderms, and they're grazers. They graze seaweeds and understory algae and kelp. And so with the demise of the sunflower sea stars, we believe that's allowed the sea urchin populations to really flourish. Their numbers have gone up very high, and their grazing activities have really become much more extensive. So they've grazed down the food web and removed understory algae and kelp beds, and that's caused problems for other grazers like abalone. Then have been showing signs of starvation, and their populations are declining. So as you can see, you know, the removal and loss of the top dog in the system has had what we call trophic links or trophic cascades throughout the food web, and it's caused these disruptions. Here on the Oregon coast, we've had about 80 to 90% loss of our kelp beds in the nearshore Rocky Reef areas. But some areas the kelp beds still persist, so it hasn't happened everywhere. And so we've initiated new work to try to figure out what's going on in areas like the Orford Reef areas or some of the marine reserves in the South Coast where kelp beds have declined and sea urchin populations are higher, and compare that to other areas like the South Cove at Cape Arago near Charleston, or down off the Rogue Reef areas off the mouth of Gold Beach, north of the Rogue River. In those areas, the kelp beds still are persisting. And so we're interested if the sea urchin populations have really gone up, or do we still perhaps have sunflower sea stars still alive at those sites, initiating new surveys in the underwater zones at those locations.
Wonderful. Thank you. That would be great to see them bouncing back. And so what is the current status of the population of the sunflower sea star for Oregon? You said that they had declined by roughly 90%. What is the population now?
Yes. So the population now is in that state of very serious decline. And we've put a moratorium on any take of sea stars, all species of sea stars. The Center for Biological Diversity has filed a petition to the federal government to place them on the threatened endangered species list. So NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, is currently going through all of that material and putting together their recommendations for placement of the species there. So they're going to make their decision by mid-January or so. We expect that decision to be announced to the public. And so they may gain status either as a threatened or endangered species. And then that decision will be placed out for public comment and public review. And then we expect the final decision to follow thereafter. So at this point today, here in December, they are being considered for status, federal status on listing on the ESA list. And we should hear in early 2023 about the federal decision.
That's good. I thought they were already listed as endangered with how low their population is.
They are listed as critically endangered by the International Union for Conservation of Nature. So that's an international group. And then what I was just describing was for the United States federal government listing on the U.S. Endangered Species Act.
So tell me about the road to recovery for the sunflower sea stars.
Yeah, so a group of scientists and agency investigators, tribes, non-governmental associations, about 20 different authors, came together under the guidance and organization of the Nature Conservancy over this year and put together an important planning document. So that planning document is called the Roadmap to Recovery for the Sunflower Sea Star. And what it does is it describes the situation faced by these sea stars, as I just described, and then puts forth a detailed action plan calling for new research and actions to help address recovery. What we're trying to do is keep the sunflower sea star from going extinct and help clear the pathway for steps and actions by various groups that might help facilitate the recovery of this species.
Wonderful. Thank you.
And we will be back with this episode of Living Downstream real soon.
We need to talk about our future.
It's time to bring attention to pollution and renewable energy.
Did you know
more than 3 million kids under age of 5 years die every year due to environmental factors like pollution?
And that approximately 46% of the lakes in America are extremely polluted and are risky for fishing and swimming.
Or that forests influence climate change mainly by reducing the amount of carbon dioxide in the air.
Also, each one of us living in the United States produces around 4 pounds of garbage every day.
That contributes to about 14 billion pounds of garbage dumped in the ocean. Most of it is plastic and ends up being a part of the Pacific Ocean garbage patch, which is 6 times the size of Oregon.
What can we do about this?
Avoid buying or using products that are made of single-use plastics, such as straws and plastic grocery bags.
Use more renewable energy sources and less fossil fuels. Take initiative and host a river cleanup event. River cleanups can save animals' lives. Become a steward for our forests by using less wood-based products and demand better forest management practices.
Join a nonprofit that is focused on environmental improvement.
We must act now.
My future depends on it.
And we are back.
How do you guys plan to go about achieving this goal?
Yeah, so our roadmap for recovery document really focuses in on 7 specific objectives. And they're first to just develop a common understanding about the recovery goals and different criteria to evaluate the success or failure, how to evaluate this threat. You can imagine, so we're trying to do this throughout the biogeographic realm. So it includes coming to agreement with Alaska, British Columbia, Washington, Oregon, California, and Baja, Mexico. And throughout those geographic areas, agreement amongst the federal government scientists and agency resource managers, the affected tribal entities, the non-governmental groups that have conservation concerns, various groups that may have concerns about biosecurity and permitting and movement of species from one area to another. So it's a large group of people. So that's the first objective, just get everybody on the same page. The second is to maintain and enhance research and monitoring. So like we spoke about earlier, there isn't complete agreement about the actual cause of mortality. So we're putting a big emphasis on continuing this fundamental research to figure out really what is causing death. And at the same time, the need to monitor, to keep eyes and ears out in the subtidal zone that puts their primary habitat, and to provide a way for those observations by citizens, by scientists, by fishermen, if they happen to catch some, or anyone that's out doing underwater surveys, to pool that information together into a common database so we know really where, you know, the status of the populations, and if we do have any observations, we want to share them. The third objective is, as I mentioned, really to refine and expand the research, not only on the disease itself, but on ways to help perhaps develop resistance or resilience. The aquaria, the public aquaria and visitor centers are partners in this. So we do have some captive individuals in the aquaria and visitor centers, and they can play a big role because they've got control over those species there and could help us with the recovery of some of those captive individuals. Objective 4, there's an active program led by the University of Washington to place sunflower sea stars into a captive breeding and reproduction. And that work is showing great progress. So we've been able to spawn and raise the planktonic larvae that are up in the water column anywhere from 40 to 60 days to feed them properly so that they can develop through their stages into later stage larvae and settle back out onto the bottom, figured out the right food and habitat for them as embryos and little post-larvae, able to let them survive and grow up into juveniles and into mature into adults. So all of that work is making great progress over the last couple of years. An Oregon scientist, a woman who's working on her degree up in Portland State University, is headed up there to learn or contribute to that effort up in the San Juan Islands and to help out with that effort up at the Friday Harbor Labs this winter. So we're going to have some expertise in when Allie comes back to help us plan for this in the future here in Oregon. The fifth objective is to make plans for possible outplanting into locations where the populations have declined. So in the event that the broodstock production can produce decent numbers of adults, then we may be able to move them from the broodstock locations out into the field and place sunflower sea stars back out. There can, you know, issues associated with that, with caging and trying to make sure they're healthy and happy. And that leads into the sixth objective, is to deal with the permitting issues associated with moving organisms from one geographic location to another. We're all on the same board thinking that's a good idea and need to make plans to do that. But we're also very cautious about possibly introducing genetic lineages that may carry diseases, or diseased individuals that might have picked up that disease and then had resistance, or bringing it into our populations in an area where the C-star wasting disease may have dissipated. So those kind of issues there. And then finally, objective number 7 is to develop public outreach events and materials to really increase public awareness about the loss of sea stars in general and the decline of sunflower sea stars in particular, and the efforts that are being undertaken to help keep the population from going extinct, how the public can contribute their observations into a common citizen science database, and to move forward along those kind of lines. I thank you for your efforts to publicize this. So you're helping us meet that 7th objective right here. So thank you.
Yeah, of course. It's important to get the information out there. What would you say the primary objective for the road to recovery would be?
The overall, I just went through the 7 specific objectives, but the overall goal is to help enhance the population and facilitate recovery throughout its biogeographic range. And we hope to do that to the level that they become self-sustaining again and can perform as they did in the environment, carry on those good ecosystem functions that not only benefit themselves, but are good for maintaining a healthy subtidal marine community in these areas. That's our overall goal.
Thank you. Do you think there would be an opportunity in the near future for, say, college students looking to get involved with this and wanting to learn more about sea stars? Do you think there would be any opportunities for them as the road to recovery continues?
Yes. So I'm aware that California just had a great event called Sea Star Solstice. Yesterday was the solstice. And so what that was just a chance to go out at nighttime in the intertidal zone and simply count the numbers of sea stars that we see. Typically, people will go out in the daytime tides in the spring and summertime and we'll report back. But we don't have very many observations out in the nighttime low tides. So I could see us putting together an opportunity here for students, members of the public to participate in evening or nighttime surveys. BioBlitz surveys are sometimes talked about. They're kind of like the Christmas bird counts that occur for keeping tabs on the biodiversity and location abundance of birds. You would likely put together those types of opportunities for sea star monitoring here too.
Wonderful. I think a lot of people in our community would definitely be interested in participating. Our annual bird count just happened and it was a great turnout.
Yeah, they're great events. They take a lot of organization and really appreciate the dedication of folks, volunteers that come out to participate, really generate very useful information.
Yes, I agree. Do you have any personal observations that you can share about these sunflower sea stars?
Well, there's a couple of things I'd like to leave you with here. One thing that is important, I talked about the life history of sunflower sea stars. Imagine they're big, separate sexes. You know, there's male sea star and female sea stars. They have to become get close proximity for spawning to be successful. And the males will release sperm, the females will release eggs. In the ocean currents, those clouds of gametes become dilute very quickly. So they have to be in close proximity to each other. And it just breaks my heart to think of individual surviving sea stars that can live for many years, wandering around out there underwater trying to find a mate. If their numbers become so low that they can't get close enough to reproduce, it's a sad romantic situation. I know that's anthropomorphizing on my part, but it just kind of breaks my heart to think of these single individuals wandering around the rest of their life, and it could be years, to try to find a mate. it also breaks my heart to just see these populations just decline so dramatically, so quickly. You know that humans have had great impacts, and we're seeing a very large number of animals going extinct here recently, in particular with climate change, and we're likely seeing that here in the ocean as well. And it's very frustrating because there isn't much that we can do. We don't have a dedicated targeted fishery that we can stop or anything like that that would take them. They're not gathered for souvenirs or for sale in gift shops or anything. It's just really a marine disease that has hit a species that we recognize as ecologically important. And it's very frustrating to not be able to do much. So we have gathered our efforts together, put together the roadmap for recovery, and hopefully we can make a difference and curb this before it takes them off of our list of extant species.
And how do you think this loss of these big predators will affect you as a marine biologist?
Well, I think that, I've been a marine biologist for 40, 45 years, and we've seen some other extinctions have occurred at that time, but never anything of this scale, rapidity, and something as big and iconic. And it just really opens my eyes up to the vulnerability of our marine environment and to the changes in the communities and habitats and to species. Sunflower stars are something that scuba divers are used to seeing. They've been rare, but always bring joy to your heart as you see something that big and effective out there and just living in its own world so different. It's something that you really can relate to. Seeing them decline like this is hard to watch.
Since I live in Oregon and I would love to see a sunflower sea star, where could I go to see one?
Well, right now you can go into the Oregon Coast Aquarium up here in Newport, and there's a tank that has three big healthy sunflower sea stars. So I just went in and saw them about a week ago, and it made me smile to see how healthy they look in there. But it's rare to find them out in the wild now, so it'd be very difficult to go and observe one in nature. We put the word out, and so when people do see them, they let us know. And so far, a couple of scuba divers who are well aware have let us know they found a couple off of Cape Arago down near Charleston. We had a report of three small juveniles found in eelgrass beds up in Neatarts Bay last summer, but they're pretty rare. Very difficult to go find them right now other than in the bird.
And if someone was out looking, is there any possibility that they would confuse it with a different sea star?
We do have several species that have many rays. And so the sunflower sea stars are pretty big. A medium-sized one would be about the size of a dinner plate, and a big one about the size of a garbage can lid. There are some other multi-rayed sea stars, soul asters, but they've got a different appearance and a much more leathery skin than the softer body of the sunflower stars. They don't have as many rays. So there's a number of guides out there. Most of the seashore guides do a pretty good job of showing the difference. But any big multi-rayed sea star, we'd like to have an observation of them. Again, I'll provide you with the website where people can send those observations.
Thank you. I kind of have a unique question. I have heard that sea stars can regrow when they lose a limb. Is that possible to regrow from one limb?
Well, from a single ray, I don't think it's possible for them to regrow the whole body. A body that's lost multiple rays but still maintains the essential guts and parts can then regrow. Just a piece of a fragment will not be able to regrow. The whole body can regrow those missing appendages.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Are they able to asexually reproduce if there is an issue of not finding a mate?
Some species, not, we don't think that the sunflower sea star can do that, but some species do have that ability to come apart right down the middle and have enough of the interior guts to be able to survive that kind of division.
Okay.
There's a little note, the larvae, the planktonic microscopic larvae, when they're up and floating in the water column, it looks like it may be possible for them to also asexually bud off significant bits of tissue that that have, we call them stem cells, that can develop into other organs. So it may be possible for the larvae themselves to asexually reproduce.
That's very cool.
But
do you have any other information you would like to provide?
Well, again, I'd just like to say thank you very much for taking this issue up and for sharing it with your listeners. And we really appreciate concern about the marine environment. You know, we are in this situation that I'm calling unprecedented in recorded history, where a marine heat wave, you know, a very large mass of warmer than normal seawater, developed along the Oregon coast and coast of Alaska and Russian and British Columbia. And that persisted for several years, roughly 2015 on. And then it was followed by a pretty normal El Nino condition, which is also warmer than normal. So our marine environment experienced several years of warm water, and it's had dramatic implications with helping facilitate this loss of sea stars and the spread of disease, the decline in kelp, the very dramatic increase in abundance of urchins, and the decline of our grazing abalone and other disruptions. So we're in a situation where we're really seeing changes in the marine habitat and are studying it now and starting to understand just how extensive and what the magnitude is. So we appreciate continued interest and support from your listeners as we go through this process to learn about really how fragile and how responsive our marine environment may be to a changing global climate and how that manifests itself in changing ocean conditions along the Oregon coast.
Wonderful, thank you. Is there any species that the sunflower sea star feeds on that would proliferate when they're gone?
Well, we're seeing that with the purple sea urchins that have really increased, but the sunflower sea stars are generalists.
Okay.
So they're feeding on crab, juvenile crab, feeding on sea cucumbers and brittle stars and there's some observations that they could even capture and feed on slow demersal fish. And so any of those generalist type prey items would be able to flourish, you know, once the major predators are gone.
Okay. Is there anything that would, any predator that eats the sunflower starfish?
Well, they're cannibalistic, so they eat each other. And so that's one of the problems that the broodstock people have to keep them separate. The kids fight and they'll eat each other. So they have to be raised up as individuals. But other than that, you know, there isn't really much that feeds upon them. Once they get to be a decent size, you know, they're probably pretty immune from being preyed upon by anything other than themselves.
That's good. So the sea star wasting disease is really what's impacting them most.
That's the primary impact.
Yeah. Thank you for listening to this episode of Living Downstream.